You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Mr. Jones's Neighborhood. Good morning, neighbor. I'm glad we're together again. We have a very special show for you today on Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, the children's program for reluctant adults. I'm the host of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, Ken Jones, no relation, by the way. We're now in pandemic month 6, I think, though it seems like years. And you can certainly tell it's affecting our little neighborhood here. It used to be such a quiet and friendly place, but the pandemic and all the sheltering in place has taken its toll. Our good friend Bob across the street grew a long beard and acquired a few disturbing tattoos, all self-administered with a rusty needle and a tub of red dye number 2. Bob's wife Melania, a virtuous woman under normal conditions, took up with a white supremacist from just north of the state border, and their son Tiny Jr. bought an assault rifle and became a professional influencer on TikTok. Our friendly mailman Ernie has gone postal, so to speak, handing out absentee ballots to everyone on his route, ballots for a fictional election, which has Ernie running for Postmaster General and winning. And my puppet friend King Friday the 13th declared himself president for life and hired an army of off-duty Portland police officers to defend his realm. Well, that's pretty much the state of our neighborhood in a nutshell. And speaking of neighborhoods, we have a show to do. It's a very special show today, mainly because there's very little of Mr. Jones himself in the episode. After this opening rant of mine, we'll hand things over to Kent Russell and Karen Russell to talk about Kent's new book, In the Land of Good Living, A Journey to the Heart of Florida. The book recounts Kent's walk along with two friends across the entire state of Florida from the Panhandle to the Keys just before the 2016 election with the intent of filming a documentary of their adventures. In the book, Kent shares his discoveries in a series of often funny, moving, and always entertaining stories about the people he meets and the places he visits. Love it or hate it or a little of both, Florida is endlessly fascinating and Kent's a wonderful guide. Kent and Karen Russell, if you haven't already guessed, are brother and sister, native Floridians born and raised in Miami, and both are amazing writers. In addition to In the Land of Good Living, Kent's work includes the book I Am Sorry to Have Raised a Timid Son and essays for The New Republic, Harper's Magazine, GQ, N+1, The Believer, and Grantland. Karen's work includes the novel Swamplandia, the novella Sleep Donation, and three collections of short fiction, St. Lucy's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves, Vampires in the Lemon Grove, and Orange World. I had the great joy of talking with Karen previously for Mr. Jones's Neighborhood and KBOO's Between the Covers show, and loved listening to her conversation with Kent about the new book and the state of Florida, and I think you'll feel the same. So here goes. Let's join Kent and Karen as they talk about In the Land of Good Living, A Journey to the Heart of Florida.
So hello, Ken. Ken Jones has generously agreed to let us take over his neighborhood this week. So it's some Russell on Russell interviewing and just a delight. I love being a guest on the show, and it's a special thrill to get to hold my younger brother's feet to the fire, ask him some questions about his latest book, which is brilliant, hilarious, masterful capture of our very complex home state, In the Land of Good Living, A Journey to the Heart of Florida. Hi, Kent.
Hey, Karen. And yeah, allowing someone a Russell takeover is a mistake they only make once. So, sorry. But yes, this book is about a 1,000 plus mile pedestrian journey that I and two friends made along and down the length of Florida and then some. And it's really an attempt to capture not only the history of our home state, but also really kind of the psychogeography of it. What I really hope that people take away from it is not just a deeper understanding of Florida, but I hope that they have kind of experienced the psychic toll that Florida takes upon you in terms of both, you know, it's kind of inherent swindling nature, and more than that, the way that it kind of holds out a special kind of promise for people. It kind of excites avarice and promises, you know, a better future, in a kind of utopian future, whether that is, you know, you go to Florida like the conquistadors did in the hopes of finding riches, or you go to Florida because you're a retiree and you hope to, you know, live out your sunny, you know, end of days in the beautiful, you know, subtropical climate or whatever it may be. So, you know, I hope that the book not only gives people the kind of nuts and bolts as to how Florida became what it is, but also I hope to kind of give them the roller coaster ride of despair that oftentimes comes along with it.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the amazing successes of this book and the structure that you discovered, brother. Maybe we could start with the epigraph, which is sort of in line with the project of drawing, tracing a through line from the earliest conquistadors with their exploitation of Florida, with obviously devastating consequences to its indigenous people, all the way up to, you were writing this book sort of a month before the 2016 election. So there are two epigraphs. Even if Florida does not believe in history, it cannot help but believe in the tide, and the tide for its part is a compelling historian. Campbell McGrath, amazing South Floridian poet. We went there to serve God and also to get rich. Bernal Diaz del Castillo, conquistador. How do you understand that 1-2 operating? What spell are you casting there?
A big reason for my wanting to write this book, and I know that this you're familiar with this experience yourself, Karen, is that when you are a native Floridian and you venture outside of the state, which I didn't really do until I was 23, 24, I had been kind of homegrown and in the hothouse of Florida until then. And it didn't really hit me until I had left the state that, you know, Florida is not just the butt of many a joke to people outside of Florida, but it's also kind of this mystifying madhouse, you know, and when somebody discovers that you're actually not, or that you're actually from the place, they see that you're, you know, not completely insane. They kind of sidle up to you and ask to know, you know, what's going on down there, man? What can you explain that place to me? So the book itself kind of grew out of that that impulse that others have, and in my kind of experience with having to explain my home state to them. And so to that end, I include that kind of impulse and that response early on in the book, in which I explain to one of my traveling companions, who is himself kind of a wonderfully kind and guileless Canadian who had never really been to Florida. And I had to catch him up to speed as to what the place is about. So here early on in my book, I say, first I had to enlighten Glenn, which was easy enough since every native Floridian, regardless of occupation, happens also to be a psychoanalyst of our state. This is because people, when they find out one is actually from the place and they see that our eyes are clear and we do not twitch involuntarily like a sleeping pack animal, tend to take us by the arm and wonder earnestly, just what is the deal with Florida? The deal with Florida, I told Glenn, is the charlatans and lunatics and Snapchat famous plastic surgeons. It is the Ponzi schemes, the Byzantine corruption, the evangelical fervor, and the consenting adult depravity. It is the seasonless climate, the lack of historical consciousness, the way in which this nation's unctuous elements tend to trickle down as though Florida were the grease trap under America's George Foreman grill. It is the bath salts. It is all of the above and more on top of that. Its name means feast of flowers, I explained, but what Florida has come to connote is hucksters, boosters, and fly-by-night mountebanks, carpetbaggers, chicanerers, and salesfellows who grafted the American dream onto strange roots in sandy soil. These rule breakers and rainmakers constructed modern Florida within the last 70-odd years. They were able to do this because, unlike those of Hawaii and California, Florida's plots of land were bogged cheap, its taxes non-existent, and the flat, empty canvas of its peninsula allowed for the projection of any and all fantasies. every single day since 1950, about 1,000 people have been lured to Florida by its chimerical promise. Several hundred recent arrivals also flee every day, repelled or disillusioned by what they found, but we needn't trouble ourselves with them. In an astonishingly brief span of time, Florida has grown from a backwater of 955,000 mostly white, mostly rural, mostly southern-born inhabitants to our third most crowded state. Its population of newcomers is more ethnically, racially, and religiously diverse than the United States itself. As a result, Florida is now the petri dish whence things like stand your ground laws, core curricula, and majority-minority city governments spring. It is where fabulous wealth, natural splendor, and unfettered desire intermingle with systemic poverty, inequality, violence, and addiction. Growth here is pegged to housing and defense industries, the largesse of corporate giants, the fairy tale of expansion and perpetuity. And yet, for all the rhetoric about entrepreneurship, global convergence, and affordable mortgages for all, everyday life in Florida is still tied to the service sector, is still a perilous, debt-ridden existence stitched together from the shreds of part-time shifts. Oh, and also, the rising seas caused by global climate change will wash over the state within 100 years, and we're still selling the dream, still hawking waterfront condos as fast as we can build them. This is vulgar and despair-inducing, Glenn offered in reply. Yes, fine, whatever, I said. But know that the vulgarity and despair exist only because of the rest of the country. Florida is a pure creation of others' demand. It is a reflection of the hopes and wants of America at large. Florida's retirees, its vacationing families, its Araviste millionaires looking for second homes and tax havens, to say nothing of the losers and dreamers and petty criminals who drive down the map in search of orange groves, smoking rivers, and third chances. These people are us. There was a simpler way to put it, I said. Florida, America concentrate.
Thanks, Kent. I love that section, and it comes pretty early on in the book, and it really sort of lays out the project of the book. I love, you know, this book got, I feel like this is my one opportunity to praise Kent in ways that make him uncomfortable. I got a rave review from Lauren Groff, another brilliant Floridian writer in The Atlantic, and she said, to try to understand this most incomprehensible state, we need varied and probing narratives, ones that change as Florida changes and are told by people who love the state too deeply to refrain from blistering criticism. Into this role steps the native South Floridian memoirist Kent Russell with his sharp, brilliant, mean, and exasperating hybrid book, In the Land of Good Living, by Exasperating. I mean, I've never read an account of our gorgeous and messed up state that is a more appropriate match of form and function. Russell's book is a braid of diverse strands that shouldn't work together and yet do. So I thought maybe, I mean, I wonder a little bit about how you, you know, discovered both like this decision to follow in Walk and Lawton Chiles, our former governor and senator's footsteps, literal footsteps down the state of Florida. And also maybe I'm just, you know, so much of this book, like many Florida stories, feels like a collision of expectations and reality and sort of like, you know, like a, you can just almost pinpoint on the map where optimism becomes delusion. And maybe that happens at a little bit of a different place for each of the three of you, the three friends who are on this journey. Did you initially envision writing something a little more straight? Can you talk about the strands that are braided together that Lauren mentions?
Sure. And, you know, every one of my friends who has seen that review applauds Lauren Groff for her pinpointing that I am mean. So, you know, there you go, Groff. But so one thing that probably needs to be explained is that part of the impetus for the journey itself was Florida's beloved and late former governor and senator Lawton Chiles, when he launched his political career in middle of the last century. He was, you know, relatively obscure, unknown, and to kind of both introduce himself to the electorate and to get to know the state of Florida, perhaps better than anyone had ever known it up to that point, he embarked upon this 1,000-mile kind of walking, talking, listening, you know, handshaking campaign. And, you know, that did launch him into prominence. He won the governor's office, you know, he became a senator. And so, you know, that was always something in the back of my mind, was that, you know, the person who knew Florida the best was the person who actually saw it kind of at the granular level and at walking speed. And so there was that element, like the actual physical journey itself was kind of born of wanting to, you know, if I'm going to attempt to capture Florida, I'm going to have to see it, in, you know, in the same way that Lawton did. And I'm going to have to put myself, you know, in that kind of grave physical and moral peril. There was also at that time, you know, every few years, the government puts out these reports as to, you know, how we're doing in terms of pedestrian safety. And at that point in time, which is around 2016, the four most dangerous pedestrian cities in the United States of America were Jacksonville, Tampa, Orlando, and Miami. So, you know, there was a rather large level of risk involved in all this. But yeah, that was kind of the physical aspect of the idea. And then a friend of mine who I had done some writing programs with, he has since smartly pivoted to video. And, you know, he was working as a documentary film producer. When I ran the idea by him, you know, it kind of lit up all of the ambition centers of his brain, as he had wanted to himself kind of direct something and be involved really in all aspects of making a documentary. So he wanted to film it as we went along. And, you know, once we finally got down there and finally began to do the thing, we realized that, you know, the actual exigencies of attempting to do this are just almost overwhelming. So, you know, it's exhausting, mm-hmm. obviously, especially for guys who are, let's just say, you know, physically indelicate, who are perhaps not the best athletes and maybe didn't exactly train for this. So it, aside from it just being almost overwhelming on the physical level, there's also tied into that just the fact that you can't really spend a lot of time in a place if you want to, you know, interview people or set up film shoots or something like that. You really have to kind of thread the needle in terms of logistics. And so to your question about kind of when does reality give way to like fantasy and perhaps a certain level of swindling was when we realized that, you know, as we traverse the state, you know, and I, and then the third of our compatriots, a guy named Noah, who is also from Florida, you know, we kind of explain to our friend who goes by the name of Glenn in the book, we explain to Glenn that, you know, in fact, for all of his guileless and well-meaning Canadianness and his kind of fealty to the truth, that in fact, were you to really attempt to do this in a straightforward and truthful way, you would be missing entirely the point of Florida, which is that, you know, from its earliest days, you know, for five centuries, this place, if you take it at face value and, you know, and if you attempt to kind of do it straight down here, this place will destroy you. And so I would say about a third of the way through the journey, we come to realize that actually playing it straight is the least Floridian thing we could do. So, it with the best of intentions, we embarked on the trip in the hopes of being able to give Florida the kind of straight-laced, affectionate, but also, serious and interrogative portrait that it deserved. And then we realized that the place just kind of physically rejects that. So we... in the same way that water kind of tries to find, you know, it'll flow until it finds level. We played it straight until we realized the place just can't be covered straight. So things get a little more chaotic, yeah. And a little more underhanded after that.
It's funny, you know, I mean, and I this is just something that I think we both have in common, and it's a real lucky thing and a scary thing too, to have a sibling who's a writer, I'll just say. Because I think you're one of the people I'm closest to on this planet, and I still was surprised. I was surprised by some of the history of our home state, particularly in Northern Florida, that I really didn't know about. But also, you know, about your own secret depths and even the structure of your book, which I don't know if this is so obvious to anybody but us, but I wrote a novel called Swamplandia about a family that has sort of this alligator wrestling theme park. And so much of the impetus behind that book for me was that this is a state where fantasy is the great industry. And it was also sort of like the microcosm of a family where, you know, a fiction becomes dangerous, you know, where sort of the in a really literal way, you know, you're standing on these sinkholes. There's this artificial bedrock and little respect for, you know, the truly sublime and terrifying reality of Florida. And I, you know, there, so I do think that you can't really tell this story of if there's something that unifies this state, which has so many microclimates, different, you know, I think that's something that comes through in the book too. You do these switchbacks from red parts of the state to blue parts of the state, you know, from the coasts to sort of the armpit of Florida. And you see that it's like a Frankenstein monster, right? It's not really a monolith the way that people think. But if there's something that unifies the state, it might be just the fantasy that's for sale everywhere. And the great lore, you know, the great seduction of that.
Yeah, I think that's an important point to bring up for people who maybe aren't familiar or as familiar with the state. You know, one thing about Florida that I think just is a continuous source of interest for people is that everybody kind of knows, or everybody has a relative who lives in Florida or who's planning on retiring in Florida, or everybody's been to Disney World, or, you know, everybody has some kind of 6 degrees of separation from Florida. And so I think that the interest is kind of evergreen, but maybe what people don't realize is that the actual history of the state rather mirrors that of kind of the Western frontier. When you begin in something like the Panhandle, you know, it is just so completely different from something like South Florida. And you can just see these kinds of almost like striations in rock, or like, you know, the rings of a tree or something in Florida, wherever you are geographically, kind of represents this kind of different, either like era of kind of colonizing it, as it were, or just a different kind of era of development. So that as you go kind of south, you kind of get closer and closer to the present day, or at least the present day as it's experienced by, you know, a lot of, you know, Americans on the coast or in cities or whatever. And until basically you arrive, as I like to think of it, as the future, which is Miami, which is kind of like the something like a North Star for the future of the country. But
that's exactly it. Sort of. So Miami, where we grew up, you know, and you mentioned this, that there are tides of, you know, different cultures, you know, titling languages. It feels very in constant revision, huge, you know, fluxes of new demographics of people all the time. And it was a really exciting place to grow up. The Panhandle, Northern Florida, you know, I think we spent a lot less time up there. And if we did, we were more or less tourists ourselves. So I wanted to ask you about those two narratives that you talk about, the transient Florida story, right? And also, you know, the story of South Florida, which is one of continuous revision, tides of immigration. And it's sort of mirrored in some ways, even by the ecology. There are these coastlines that also feel like they're in continuous revision. You're right on the edge of the water. It is a frontier, and it's the southernmost part of our country. It's, you know, many people think of Miami as like a Latin American capital. And then you have Northern Florida and the Panhandle, which, you know, paradoxically, the further north you go, the more southern the state feels, is the old bromide. You meet these shrimpers, Gabriel and Wes. And Gabriel says, some people think beaches, but I think pine trees, palmetto ridges, and shrimping. That's Florida to me. And I wondered a little bit about if you wanted to compare and contrast sort of people's idea of Florida as a state of snowbirds and retirees, right? Versus, you know, and also sort of immigrants, you know, newer arrivals to America. And then the ecology and history of old Florida and North Florida, which I think kind of gets shorter shrift in the cultural imagination. Was there anything, since we have not, that's a place that we haven't spent that much time. I just imagine you felt like an explorer there yourself. Was there anything that surprised you about the culture of North Florida in contrast to where we grew up?
Yeah, I mean, North Florida is basically a part of the South, you know, the northwest corner of the state abuts Alabama and all that. And it's an area of the state that just depends very much on defense spending. And there are a lot of, you know, military bases there as well. So it is kind of, for somebody who is from Pensacola, like my friend Noah, who did the trip with me, he's from an area of the Panhandle there. Like, South Florida is just as alien to him as would be, you know, California. So Florida itself being what I believe to be is almost like a microcosm of the wider country, it does have those geographical kind of distributions that are where the people just have completely different worldviews and kind of first principles and all the rest of it. So in the same way, you know, it's, this is true to some extent for every state in the union where, you know, political and lifestyle and philosophical divides can rather usefully be summed up by geography a lot of the time, you know, like the urban versus the suburban, the exurban and rural, basically. But yeah, Florida definitely has that in spades. And it's not just, you know, you can easily and quickly kind of subdivide Florida into three Floridas, North, Central, and South Florida. But truly, I mean, you can get as many as six Floridas and then, you know, more Floridas after that. And that's kind of what, to go back to my original inarticulate point about Florida and the various striations that are, that can be found there, is truly Florida is like this black box where whatever it is about America that interests you or that you wish to know more about, you can find it in Florida. You know, it's like, it's like a magician's hat almost, where, you know, you stick your hand in there and you can pull anything out. So I think that really what was interesting or perhaps surprising about North Florida was just simply that, you know, it's so kind of alien from our experience in South Florida. And yet at the same time, you know, it's just one more part of really what kind of makes it so hard to come up with like a totalizing Florida experience. Like you can't, There is no one way to kind of know or have experienced Florida. And, you know, it's very difficult to synthesize. And really all the best that I could hope to do and the best that my friends and I could hope to do, especially in attempting to create a documentary, was, you know, this kind of litany of moving through this kind of patchwork state where, as you were saying before, really the only thing that unifies people is that, you know, this place is basically whatever you want to make of it, you know, and that's kind of the history of it, especially in terms of, you know, for lack of a better or less ominous verb, luring people to it, you know, as I mentioned in the reading there, like part of the promise of Florida is that it does appear to be this kind of blank space, this almost green screen upon which you can kind of project your fantasies. So, I mean, old Florida is exactly that. It is old. Most people up until World War II lived, you know, a day's wagon ride from the border with Georgia, the border with Alabama. They were very much culturally and like ethnically, you know, white Southern. And really, that's what Florida was. It was the panhandle. And so perhaps there's a little less fantasy about it than the rest of the country. But the same thing that kind of propped up the panhandle in world, you know, coming into World War II, which was defense spending. That's also was this kind of turbocharged kind of jet engine for what would then create what we know as modern Florida. You know, Florida as it exists today really has only existed for the past, you know, 70 odd years. And all of that very much had to do with World War II and military spending, where all these forts and training centers were built in Florida because it was this kind of undeveloped, wild place that just had so many disparate landscapes in it. And a lot of Americans, you know, one in seven service persons came to Florida to train or, you know, or to ship out. Both of our grandparents. Yeah, right. Both our maternal grandfather and our paternal grandfather, they both came to Florida from elsewhere to train, and then they both came back. And that's, you know, really what happened. Florida, you know, was one of, if not the smallest states in the South for the longest time. And then after, you know, 1950 to the present day, it explodes and becomes the third most populous state in the nation. So yeah, anyway, that's a long-winded way of saying that I think what I was most kind of struck by in the panhandle was the realization that, you know, Florida just has this tie to both, you know, the military, but also like war-making has kind of been a huge spur for Florida, not simply after World War II, but also even before that, the actual exploration of the state and mapping it out and trying to build, you know, outposts within this kind of boggy hellscape was only feasible with, you know, within a kind of military infrastructure. So even Miami used to be Fort Dallas. You know, Orlando, Tampa, all these places were previously these military bases where, you know, they were, the government was conducting wars of Indian removal and things like that. But yeah, I think in terms of North Florida, that the kind of the presence and legacy of the military is really what struck me the most.
You're listening to Mr. Jones's Neighborhood on KABU Community Radio. On today's show, our guest is Kent Russell, author of the new book, In the Land of Good Living, A Journey to the Heart of Florida, in conversation with Kent's sister, Karen Russell, author of, among several books, the story collection Orange World and the novella Sleep Donation, due out next month in a new vintage paperback edition.
Absolutely. And you know, it's so funny you mentioned that, because I did feel also researching Swamplandia that there were so many secrets hiding in plain sight, or, you know, these open secrets in the names of cities and counties and swamps and parks. And you mentioned sort of like the silk screen that we can graft all of our fantasies on. It's like, it's just no surprise that Cape Canaveral is also in Florida, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember reading that the highest percentage of rocket scientists lived in Cocoa Beach in the 50s, you know, because the space program was also unsurprisingly Floridian. There was some detail about how all of the alligators bellow at the same frequency as the shuttles when they launch. This is something that I never asked you and wish that I had. And it has less to do with sort of macro Florida stuff. But I, you know, you mentioned the putting yourself at risk. And some of the risks are very physical here. Not just, you know, the fact that you might get run over by a car at any time, but you're sleeping in a tent, this bubble of vulnerability on the side of the highway for many hundreds of nights, right? With your two friends. So there's also the risk of human intimacy. And I wondered what the tensest point of this trip was.
Yeah, you know, that it is not often that somebody spends, you know, 4 months on the road in close proximity. And, you know, not just close proximity, but say like sleeping nude in a tent with somebody who, you know, with whom they are not married. And that one thing that, you know, my friend Noah brought up and that other people that I know who are veterans brought up is not to trivialize, obviously, the terrible experience of being a veteran, of going into combat, but they brought up the point that that kind of experience that's both not just destructive on one's feet and, you know, physical architecture, but is also just so grueling, and grueling in a way that is really kind of indescribable to anybody who hasn't done it. I mean, like that kind of experience of walking along the roadside 18 inches away from, you know, speeding trucks, it's not even kind of, I don't think, consonant with something like a walking the Appalachian Trail or something, you know, aside from the fact that thank God there were no elevation changes. But it was just kind of such an ordeal, both physically and mentally, and in a lot of ways spiritually, that it really is kind of indescribable. And it is something that, you know, I will now have shared that with individuals, and that sharing it will like bind us together for the rest of our lives. You know, we will always have certain kind of shibboleths and experiences, you know, that kind of have initiated us into like our own deeper and more secret relationship. So yeah, that, I mean, one part, aside from getting to know my home state a lot better, it's, you know, there is that kind of sense of kind of plumbing the depths of one's own, the cavernous, you know, darknesses that are within. And I'm not going to say, you know, at one point in the book, I kind of talk about this where, you know, I have kind of a love-hate relationship with walking narratives, kind of long overland journeys as they exist in literature and film and stuff like that, where one of the kind of tent poles of the whole genre is, that you're not just exploring this outer world, but you're also exploring the inner world, like I was just saying, but also that by the end of it, you come to some kind of truer notion of yourself, or that kind of like a butterfly emerges out of a chrysalis, like all of a sudden I have like rebaptized myself after this long penitential pilgrimage or something like that. And so, I mean, maybe it was because I was kind of resistant to that narrative or that kind of trope, but I gotta say, like, what I mostly learned and what I think everybody on the trip kind of learned is it's not that we unlocked some secret about how to be in the world or something like that, or that we returned to our home lives as, you know, more enriched or something like that. It was mostly that, you know, we realized that it's something like this journey, or like any journey really, where you are free, you're on the road and you're free to kind of, you know, structure each day as you want. And you've cut the tethers of obligation and, you know, you've left your old life behind. And that is a very alluring thing. And you could see that in the eyes of people, you know, that we encountered, both once they had gotten over their terrible fright at seeing several haggard looking men on the roadside. And once they, you know, in the space of a few seconds, they pieced together just what it was that we were doing here. You know, 2 + 2 kind of clicked into place for them. You could see this kind of dreamy, smeary smile spread across their face. And it is something that I think is very attractive for a lot of people. But once you do it for 4 months, you kind of realize that is free and is kind of almost heavenly as this can seem, you know. It seems like something that people only get to do once they've kind of died to all of their obligations and, you know, their more prosaic day-to-day existence, that they would get to do something as, you know, fun and free as this. But what we kind of came back to at the end of it was like, while it is fun and free and a great privilege to do something like this, we all like were by the end of it left with this desire to cultivate exactly that, like prosaic, more grounded lives. Like, we didn't really want to be blown about by the roadside anymore. We wanted to get like Glenn, the documentarian, now has a beautiful daughter, and you know, he's living this very much normal life in Toronto. And he kind of credits the whole trip as to setting him straight. Maybe what it was ultimately was like a grand kind of scared straight experience for all of them.
But yeah. Can I read this really quick? Because I think it's so funny. I mean, this is not giving anything away. You know, it really is about the journey here. And it's sort of, this is your prodigal return to Miami when all of these sort of epiphanies are hitting. But the Canadian Glenn, who is, as you mentioned, now has committed to fatherhood, I will say a few things. Number one, I feel like this trip was worth it, at least in the sense that I am going home with a really lucid vision of myself, just what rock bottom is. Number two, I am never coming back to Florida. Number three, plundering Florida for our personal, creative, and financial fortune, like so many before us, I definitely don't think that is going to work out. I definitely don't think that is going to happen. What I've learned is that Florida is uniquely good at taking people's capital and sinking it into the swamp. So there is, I think there is, like, there's nothing as neat as sort of the catharsis that you're expecting maybe in another kind of road memoir. And every kind of like elevated scene, or, you know, that there's beautiful high lyricism, and it feels to me like there's, particularly where you're in the Everglades, I really felt like there is the hum of just non-human autonomy all around you. And you have that beautiful description, you know, the heartbreaking beauty, the way it will continue to exist when there is no heart left to break for it. And so I think it's not that there isn't sublimity and wonder in this book. It's just that you're also never unaware of the strip malls and semis roaring by on the side of the road. And at one point, I think it's Glenn who says, you know, the people, the dentist in that strip mall is living a life that is harder than this walk. And yeah. I think there's something kind of marvelous about that acknowledgement. But interesting, too, that people really wanted you to be like the mascot of Florida, right? They saw you three dudes just kind of heckle and jekylling along the side of the road. And to them, that looked like the dream somehow. And I connect that to, you know, things that are really going wrong in this country, a strain of individualism and a sort of phony freedom, which is actually delusion, right? It's like delusive to think that you don't owe something to one another and to the land.
Yeah, that's one of the grand, or at least, well, yeah, for the past basically 500 years, Florida has existed as exactly that. This idea that, you know, oh, you're like a kind of minor noble in, you know, Castile, and your future doesn't look so great for, you know, king and country. But here's this colony where you can plunder, you can search for lost cities of gold, the fountain of youth. You can cut and run to this place. And, you know, nothing really has changed about either that kind of allure that it holds out, or it, even in your more kind of modern iterations of it, the dream was that, oh, you can finally leave behind bitter New York winters, or you can finally leave behind like your suffocating, you know, Slovakian community in the Midwest where, you know, everybody's up in your business, or you can, you know, flee political persecution in South America, or, you know, whatever it is. Florida, it is kind of like this more concentrated version of America in that it's like the home for all of those who lost or hated home. But part of, you know, the obverse side of that, the kind of negative side that nobody ever really wants to bring up, is the fact that when you do kind of advertise yourself as this place of kind of limitless freedom and liberty, especially liberty as understood as a kind of license, you know, liberty is understood as, well, finally you can come here and do all the things that you had wanted to do, but were prevented from doing by community or the kinds of strictures of place or whatever it was. But when your kind of conception of freedom is only that, then it becomes very difficult to foster something like community in Florida or anything that resembles forethought or like a kind of measured consideration of the future. So Florida, you know, and like you're saying, this is now like bled out into the wider country in a lot of interesting ways. But Florida, in us being from there, we kind of saw this day to day where they call it the Cincinnati factor, where, you know, especially retirees or other people who move to Florida from somewhere else, it does not have that emotional attachment. It is not, you know, where you're from. It is not home. And Florida is second only to Nevada in terms of having the fewest homeborn, homegrown citizens in it. So when you attract people like that whose allegiances and their heart may lie elsewhere, it's very difficult to get them to want to care about that place once they're there. It's kind of seen as exactly what we've been talking about. Like not to belabor the space, the groan-inducing space metaphors, but it's like your launching pad for, you know, for the life that you wanted to live. And so Florida is just kind of a lot of Florida is a lot of these kind of competing versions of like your own personal private utopias that have very little to do with anybody else and want very little to do with anybody else. And so being from Florida, maybe it's, I have like a false idea of like what community actually means, since I never really got to experience it too much. Maybe I have a naive and kind of idealized view of it, but that you kind of, you experience like community and like a kind of corporate identity only as like a lack, a felt lack. And so, like Florida is this kind of libertarian paradise where it's, if one thing that people on the right and people on the left could agree upon, they can kind of agree upon the animating spirit of Florida that is like, don't worry about any kind of like communitarian social stricture, and also don't worry about having to pay any income tax or anything like that. Like you're free both economically and socially to basically do with yourself whatever you will. And unfortunately, the truth of that kind of arrangement is that, you know, if I'm going to do me and you're going to do you, that doesn't leave a lot of space for us to do us, is kind of the point.
And I think that's exactly it. And there is sort of, that's how it's sold, right? It's this eternal happy hour that, and I mean, you mentioned in the book sort of, you know, people coming without feeling that obligation to, you know, the tax base of Florida being composed of people who really, they either want to golf until death, or maybe they, you know, want a second home on the beach, and then they're not really thinking about climate change. They're just thinking about their next margarita. But I will also say, you know, just to say it, of course, you know, and I know you saw some of this too, there are countervailing winds in Florida. I mean, you could, you know, there are, you know, the Friends of the Everglades, and there are, you know, the Sunrise Movement has a strong presence in Florida. The Parkside activists, who are truly amazing, are pushing back against exactly that attitude, right? You know, these the survivors of the Marjory Stoneman Douglas massacre, right? There, that's Florida too. So there are countervailing winds, I think.
Big sister, and in fact, you must allow me to self-destruct on the air. Let me paint with the broad brush. This is in true Florida spirit. You have to let me do me. I'm painting with the broadest brush possible, and come at me.
You mentioned community. One of the most hilarious chapters here, and one that was a total revelation to me, was Casadega, Florida. I didn't know about this place somehow, even though I have a strong interest in spirit, you know, in the occult. How would they describe it? The community with the highest percentage of psychics in the country.
Yeah. Spiritualism is kind of this like Victorian era like occult movements that really came into its own after the Civil War, you know, when a lot of Americans had, you know, lost loved ones, had lost lives and livelihoods to total war. And it emerged out of this profound national grief. And it was totally like a scam. It was a grift. It was
doesn't it feel like the Florida land scam meets the underworld? Like somehow they had to just.
That's exactly it. It was, you know, it was certain societies of people who claimed that they could put people in touch with their departed loved ones. And one chapter of these spiritualists, one of them was told in a dream that he had to start a Southern iteration of their spiritualist camp. And so it was founded kind of not that far from Orlando, just a few hours drive, or not even, maybe like an hour's drive from Orlando. And what it is, you know, this kind of exactly that. It's a camp. It's a communal property where all of these psychics and diviners, and they wouldn't want us to describe them in such crass terms as like fortune tellers, but the people who believe that they can be put in touch with more transcendent realities and kind of relay messages. And so it has persisted, you know, since the late 1800s to this day. And it's, I mean, I like you, I do believe in metaphysical realities that we cannot see. So I maybe I'll pull back with my enormously wide broad brush for just 1 second. And but you know, there are people who, if nothing else, they believe in what they're doing. But they attract all kinds of people from all over the state and beyond the state, who wish to know about future events, who wish to know about the world beyond this one. And what's kind of funny about it, as you pointed out, is it's because the property is kind of held in common, and it is, you can own a house in Casadega only if you are a spiritualist, like a dues-paying member of the spiritualists. But you cannot own the land beneath the house. So all of these spiritualists that we encountered had purchased their homes in Casadega right before the 2008 real estate crash. And so while they, they couldn't foresee that somehow, but they they were not only trying to sell us on, you know, palm readings and what have you, but also trying very desperately to sell their houses within Casadega. So,
Kent goes to talk with this man, Julian, who becomes like a baleful refrain in later parts of the book. And they end their conversation after Julian tells Kent that he stepped in his vibrations, and he predicts that what you're doing will bring about a change in consciousness, which that's, you know, seems like a tall order. But who are we, Maybe it will, Kent. I mean, we don't know, right?
This is like the flapping of a butterfly's wings, Karen. We don't know when this mandala.
We just don't know. He tells you a bunch of sort of Zen cones to the tune of like, the treasure is the cave. And then he closes out by saying, well, our doors are always open in Casadega. All perfect children of God are welcome to join our association. And should any perfect child of God wish to know more about spirit or anything else, they can reach me anytime at We Are One Realty. That's We Are One Realty, all one word, at hotmail.com. And yeah. I thought that was maybe the most Floridian of pitches.
Yeah. No, and that's a really good point, just in general. I obviously have a big soft spot for the spiritualists of Casadega, you know, ambivalent as I may be, but to kind of paint them as cranks or as totally predatory or whatever is, again, to kind of miss the point, right? Like their hustle is exactly as you said, like a super Floridian hustle. And what that is like, as we've been discussing, they're doing what, you know, the very ground.
Oh, they are all in, right? I mean, yeah. They're not, there's no doubt in their mind that
exactly.
They are in dialogue with another reality. And it reads as like sort of like heartwarmingly sincere. And that is a special kind of con, right? When the call is coming from inside the house.
Yeah. It's, you know, they believe, you know, some may call them deluded, you know, who knows, but if they are deluded, it's a delusion that they totally believe. And the people who come to them, they want to be convinced. They come ready to believe. They don't need to be duped. They're just asking for a reason to believe. And that is the same kind of inveigle that Florida itself holds before everybody. You know, it's not that hard to get people to want to believe that, you know, for only $5 down every month, I am actually going to, in, you know, 40 years time, have my waterfront property that I can retire to. And it will actually be like Venice. Venice, Florida will surely be like Venice, Italy. And I'll like be able to punt around the canals and like whatever else. So yeah, there's, I guess the larger point, as with all these people really, is that is the at bedrock, the kind of hustle. And it's not really a hustle if you yourself believe it, you know, and it's this kind of a beautiful, beautiful shared kind of delusional meaning making that everybody makes in Florida, where even if you have been kind of hornswoggled, like even if you do come and you step out of your car onto the land that you purchase sight unseen, and then only then do you realize is like your foot sinks up to its ankle in water that, oh God, you know, I have been had. Like there is, but people then, you know, tend not to leave. They tend to stick around and tend to, you know, you it's a way of kind of convincing oneself that Florida really is paradise, or that, you know, these things, I really am living out my dream. And there is, I guess, as we were discussing community before, there is a kind of, you know, psychic community beyond Casadega. I mean, like the psychic community of Floridians is, we kind of together like make the fantasy a reality through our kind of like shared and willed insistence that, you know, this, what we want to believe is true is actually true.
Right. And I think it's almost like a clear-eyed assessment of where we are is would lead you to such despair that you do feel compassion sometimes for people that, for example, continue to buy property in Miami Beach, even though it's projected to be underwater within our lifetimes.
It is true, and it remains true, that not only are people buying real estate on Miami Beach, which by all, you know, available projections is doomed, but, you know, we're building more and more condos and new developments, and everything kind of has the planned obsolescence built right into it. And, you know, the kind of ethos of the place is that nobody is going to really stay in the condo that they bought for more than 5 years. They're just immediately going to flip it to somebody else, and on the kind of system of inveigling somebody in and then having them, you know, get out within 5 years goes. But the true one thing that I found kind of very striking, and it was really, I mean, even if it didn't appear kind of at the end of our trip, I would consider it kind of a very large kind of important epiphany to hit upon, is that Miami Beach, you know, that's how it made itself. It literally made itself out of nothing. It made itself out of mangrove swamp and then dredged sand from Biscayne Bay. And even to this day, it needs to import sand to continue maintaining its shape as the sea saws away at it and all the rest of it. And so it is kind of this fantasy island made, you know, ex nihilo, however you pronounce that word, you know, by these kind of real estate magicians. And it willed itself into existence. It kind of self-created itself as this place where its kind of raison and its whole engine of maintaining itself is convincing people to come and live there, convincing people that this is actually an island paradise and not like this weird bog island where we've just built some hotels. And so what was originally a choice, you know, a choice to build there, a choice to have, you know, somebody to come and move and sink their fortune into, you know, a beautiful manse or something like that. Like that had continuously been a choice. It'd been, you know, this is kind of like a summation of what we've been talking about, where it's this kind of aggregation of all these individual choices, these free individual choices to come and make Miami Beach this truly beautiful, like stately pleasure dome, you know, this world-renowned kind of place of luxury and beauty. And it's completely fake. It's all just like this man-made invention. But the point of it is that all of these choices came to make this thing a reality. And now being faced with literal existential, you know, destruction, they're facing down the return of the waters, the return of like the great, you know, symbol of chaos. And they, what was originally a choice, you know, in a collection of choices, there's no choice anymore for them. If they want Miami Beach to continue to exist, what was originally a choice is a choice no longer. They just have to keep selling that dream, keep getting people to come and pay taxes and all the rest of it, because as soon as they stop doing that, the place will be swallowed by the sea.
Well, I think we'll stop while we're ahead here with Miami and most of the state of Florida, for that matter, still above water. That's all for this episode of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood here on KABU Community Radio, or KABU Neighborhood Radio, as I like to call it. If you missed any part of the show or would just like to hear it all again, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, or just search for it on the KABU website. Before we head out the door, a big neighborhood thank you to Kent Russell and Karen Russell. Kent's new book, In the Land of Good Living, A Journey to the Heart of Florida, is available now from fine bookstores and not-so-fine mega e-commerce sites. And Karen's novella, Sleep Donation, is due out next month in a new vintage paperback edition. Just a note that Mr. Jones's Neighborhood comes to you monthly on every fourth Friday from 11 a.m. to noon. Tune in for our next show on Friday, September 25th at 11 a.m. Hope to see you all again then. In the meantime, many thanks to the KABU staff, Jenna, Celeste, Arthur, Tammy, Asia, Althea, Jenka, Otto, and others who are keeping the station running while almost everyone else at the station is staying safe and making radio from home. And many thanks to all of you as well for listening. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying may there be better and more beautiful days ahead. Ernie, that's okay. You could just leave my ballot on the front porch.